Hello, and welcome to the On SOA podcast series. In this special set of podcasts, SOA journalist Joe McKendrick interviews the authors and contributors behind the book, SOA Design Patterns, the newest title in the Prentice Hall Service-Oriented Computing series from Thomas Earle. You can learn more about this book and download sample chapters at soapatterns.com. Also, while listening to this podcast, you can look up any design patterns being discussed at soapatterns.org, a community site dedicated to the ongoing development and expansion of the SOA Patterns catalog. For more information about other series titles, be sure to visit soabooks.com. Now, here's Joe McKendrick.
Hello, this is Joe McKendrick, independent analyst and author of the ZDNet Service-Oriented Architecture blog site, and also the EBISQ SOA in Action blog site. And I'm here with Thomas Earle, a very prolific author in the SOA and IT space, and he is talking about his latest book, SOA Design Patterns, published by Prentice Hall. And Thomas is also the founder of SOAschool.com, which provides the internationally recognized SOA Certified Professional Program. Welcome, Thomas.
Hi, Joe. Nice to talk to you again.
And this is the fourth in our original series of six podcasts. Thomas and I have been talking about the book, its purpose, the various patterns that are identified. And in this podcast, I'd like to talk about the service contract-related patterns that you and the SOA community that you established and are working with have identified as critical to SOA. Thomas, can you first tell us what a service contract-related pattern is and its purpose within the SOA effort?
Yeah, certainly. When you have, you can build services using different implementation mediums, using different technology platforms, as long as they're based on distributed computing in general. And so you can build a service as a component, as a SOAP-based web service, as a RESTful service, whatever the case might be. But when you do build it using a medium whereby the contract is separately published and you essentially establish an API into the service, I mean, that concept, of course, is nothing new. It's been part of IT development for decades, but what is of interest to us is how important it is to standardize and optimize that contract so that when we do make it available, we fully appreciate the amount of dependencies that consumer programs will form on it, and then over time, we want to ensure that we maximize the longevity of a given service contract in order to reduce the need to have to introduce new versions of the contract or introduce incompatible changes to the contract that'll break the dependency, break the relationship, break the contract with the existing service consumers. Because once we start doing that, that introduces governance burden, governance effort that we have to deal with. And when we have when we're working toward a vision of having many services, dozens or hundreds of services within a given inventory, within a given enterprise, then that becomes a very significant concern and consideration, because if over time you have a service that has for which we have to release a second, a third, and a fourth version of its contract each time, breaking the previous one, and you compound that across all the services you own or you're planning to deliver, then you can really get a sense of how beneficial it can be to pay attention to how the contracts are designed initially in order, again, to reduce the chances of that, to minimize the eventual governance burden of any given service you build. And so for that purpose, there is a set of patterns that are part of this book dedicated to service contract design, but also a number of additional patterns that have to do with the governance of service contracts as well. A fundamental pattern that is worth calling out is called contract centralization, which essentially positions the contract as the sole means by which the services, functionality, and resources can be accessed, and that is taking a step away from traditional integration approaches where we looked at perhaps the most convenient or the most performance-friendly manner of accessing resources, bypassing application logic, maybe going to the database directly, and so on. So with contract centralization, we look to really limit service interaction to the endpoints that are established by that federated endpoint layer. That's one of our ultimate target states that are created as part of our SOA environment. But some other more specialized contract-related patterns that I'll just briefly mention have to do with the evolutionary aspects of services. So even though when we model services, when we model what we call a service inventory blueprint, which is essentially a conceptualization of all the services we want to deliver within a given service inventory boundary. And one of the benefits of doing that is so that we can apply another pattern called service normalization to ensure that no two services, there's no overlap between the functional boundaries of the services or the overlap is minimized. So when we have an environment like that we're building services for, what we can do, even though we want to normalize the services themselves, it may not make sense to keep the contract itself normalized. So if you expose with the contract, whether it be methods or operations, if you're building web services that are SOAP-based, then those various operations themselves can be can evolve as required. You may not want to have just one operation or function or what we call a capability facilitate all possible consumers. You may not, for example, a GET operation. If you have a GET operation that retrieves an entire business document, you may not want to allow all consumers to use that because not all consumers may need the entire business document. They may need only a subset of the information. So contract denormalization is a pattern that provides techniques for adding redundant capabilities or operations or methods to a service contract. They are redundant in the functionality provided, but they are distinct because they usually have different levels of granularity. So what that would mean is supplementing a GET operation with a GET detail or GET header operation that provide the ability to retrieve subsets of the information that the GET operation does. That's one example of that pattern. There are a number of other patterns. Another one is concurrent contracts, allowing one service to have more than one contract, which basically allows it to facilitate different sets of consumers. It's a very common pattern that is applied when you have one service that you want to make available internally to one set of consumers and externally to a different, perhaps non-trusted set of consumers. So you might want to build security controls around the contract. You might want to only expose a subset of the functions in that contract and so on. And so there are a number of different ways of approaching it. And I'll just mention quickly one other pattern. It's not specifically a contract-related pattern, but it supports many of the patterns I've mentioned so far, and that's the service facade pattern, which essentially establishes an intermediate layer of processing within the underlying service architecture, and that allows you to further decouple contract-specific processing from underlying implementation details, and that can lead to a number of improvements you can make when you refactoring a service over time, such as behavioral correction and modification when that may result from refactoring efforts, or having different bodies of underlying service logic dedicated to different contracts so that you don't end up with bloated service logic components and so on. So there's a lot of facets to contract design.
And you touched upon something very important, and that's versioning. And you know, in the IT development world, of course, that's been a challenge in terms of developing software, especially across multiple sites. Now, when you get into the runtime, the operational aspect of SOA, versioning takes on a different presents the world basically with a different kind of challenge. There's the risk of applications or consumer applications breaking because of changes in the service that's being accessed. Does does what you're proposing here, the patterns you're proposing here, help remedy the potential nightmares companies may face with the versioning?
I hope so. There are a number of versioning patterns that are part of the service governance pattern chapter, and those also were further developed and emerged from a book that was released just recently prior to this book, which was called Web Service Contract Design and Versioning for SOA, and those had to do very much with versioning specific to decoupled contracts, like with web service-based contracts that have separate WSDL and schema definitions. But for those environments, that book established a set of versioning strategies, three distinct versioning strategies, each with its own rules and conventions, and in support of all that, there were a number of patterns, some of which were developed a while back, but some of which were provided as a result of working with that book and working with authors like David Orchard and James Paisley, who had a strong background in versioning. And these patterns are part of this catalog because they are very relevant to the governance of services. And I'll give you some examples. There is there are patterns that have to do with extending a version contract with compatible changes, applying techniques to change a contract while preserving its backwards compatibility so that consumers who've already formed dependency on the contract are not affected, or the impact upon those consumers is minimized. And that type of impact is so important, especially when you have what we call agnostic services, services with an agnostic functional context, which makes them highly reusable. And the more reusable a service is, the greater amount of consumers will tend to form dependencies on it. So backwards compatibility of the contract upon which dependencies are formed is very much a focal point. Another pattern is one called termination notification, where you can actually express within the contract the scheduled retirement of the contract itself, or maybe of portions of the contract, like there may be a specific operation or capability that's being retired and replaced. Sometimes that's a necessity due to policy regulations or various types of business factors. And other times it's just a technical issue or a platform upgrade that can lead to these types of change requirements. But termination notification is a pattern that can actually be applied by using features from the WS policy specification, whereby you can actually express the termination information, the actual notification, using ignorable policy assertions, so that you can even add it later without disrupting existing consumers, because the policy can be ignored, but it's still there. It still can be programmatically consumed, and it's still there to express when a service contract or portion thereof is scheduled for expiry.
Okay, great. And one thing I've always believed, and we've seen this evolving within the SOA web services space, is that developers, managers, companies are becoming both providers and consumers of services. Your typical site or your typical company likely does both these days. They provide services, they publish services, and they are consumers of services. Do these patterns address both sides of the provider consumer relationship?
They do. I mean, some are very specific to the provider aspect. Some are specific to the consumer aspect or the consumer role. But especially when you get into service compositions and you have services calling services that call other services, any given service will naturally transition through those roles. It'll initially be a provider, provide its functions to a consumer, but then in order to carry out those functions, based on how the inventory has been normalized and on the boundaries you've had to establish, in order to carry out its functions, it may very well be required to invoke or compose other services, so at that point it becomes a consumer. And I'll give you one example of a consumer-specific pattern. It's called partial validation, where even when you, let's say that you were retrieving information from a service and it, let's say its contract was not, you know, fully denormalized and didn't have a lot of granular variations of a base capability or operation, and you know that in advance because you're designing the consumer to access that particular part of the service, you can design it so that you can minimize the amount of unnecessary validation it has to perform when it receives the data by basically identifying what subset of the data is actually required for the consumer to do its processing in response to what it's getting from the service. So partial validation, which was another pattern that was provided by David Orchard, is essentially a means of accomplishing that by building in logic on the consumer end to help optimize its processing and also optimize interaction with the service overall. And just it's a very much a performance-centric pattern.
Okay, great. And one more question. The role of SLA, service level agreements, do the service contract patterns you've been discussing, Thomas, are these the components that will go into future SLAs that invoke or involve a lot of SOA-related services or applications?
There's certainly a relationship there. I mean, many of the patterns, in fact, most of them, are very very much focused on the technology, and the contract-related ones tend to be focused on the technical contracts. However, we do have policy-related design patterns that when you define policies for a given service, one of the initial decision points you have to deal with is, does this policy, should it be expressed in technical terms? Should it be part of the technical interface? Or should it go into the SLA and be something that a human reads, interprets, and then takes into consideration when they build the consuming logic for that service? And policy centralization is one of those patterns, so that if you do decide to move to a technical policy architecture, there are ways of creating domain and global policies so as to not have redundant policy content across services. But having said all that, an SLA is very much a common part of a service contract. When we use the term service contract, in fact, we include human-readable documents as part of that. So when we say service contract, the assumption is that an SLA is part of that, and if we're focusing on the technical interface itself, we often qualify it by saying the technical service contract so that we know we're just talking about the actual API of the service. But SLAs, that is something that, again, from a policy perspective, become very important decision points. But I cannot say that the patterns discuss SLAs in any significant manner. It's something that I'd like to see more being written about.
Okay, great. Thank you very much, Thomas. We're speaking here with Thomas Earle, author of SOA Design Patterns, published by Prentice Hall. This is Joe McKendrick, and we urge our listeners to check out the soapatterns.org site for more information on service contract-related patterns, as well as other patterns that are pertinent and essential to your service-oriented architecture efforts. And we urge you also to tune in to the next podcast in this original 6 podcast series in which Thomas will talk about service governance patterns. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this installment of the On SOA podcast series. To learn more about the Prentice Hall Service-Oriented Computing series from Thomas Earle, please visit soabooks.com. Also, all the books in the series are available online at Safari Books Online, which can be accessed at safari.informit.com.